call the meeting to order, and I would first of all like to, in order to be politically correct, Representative Norris, I would like to wish all the ladies and gentlemen on the committee a happy Valentine's Day. Tell all of you at this point in the legislative session, I love you, but that could change here, you know, shortly. So,
we're not into long-term.
So,
I could use some candy right now.
Got some up in my office. With arts. Today we have the Office of Higher Education in front of us. Ms. Heegard is here, along with Mark Mistakanis and Cheryl Mapplethorpe, who are all going to be testifying and up at the table at the same time. Welcome all of you to the committee. Susan, why don't you just go ahead and start off.
Great.
Do you have a handout for us here? I don't see it.
We do, Mr. Chair. The handout looks like this.
Okay. There it is, right at the bottom. Okay.
And we hope that our technology and our technology expert here will work well today. First of all, happy Valentine's Day. I'm here to share the love.
Did you hear my little
link? I did, and I was in the restroom.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
Yeah.
Send my love to the governor, would you?
Yes. my name is Susan Heegard. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And I wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for allowing us to speak before you today. I'm joined here by a number of staff from our agency, but I'll point out I've got the doctors with me here. I've got Dr. Mark Mishkanis and Dr. Cheryl Mapplethorpe. Cheryl heads up our financial aid programs, and Mark heads up our research and budget finance areas at the agency. And then we have various other staff here if there are questions and things that you might have. Also joining us is Tricia Grimes. It's important for you to know Tricia. She's our government relations person at the agency. At one point in time, she worked over here at the House. But Trish is very knowledgeable and very helpful. Today, we're going to talk with you, give a brief overview of higher education in Minnesota, just very briefly, and an agency overview focusing on institutions, funding, and programs. We're going to sort of trade off among us here. We'll give you some specifics about financial aid, talk about the governor's higher education recommendations, some of the language. And then I guess what I would like to ask you, Mr. Chair, is do you want to sort of take questions throughout, wait till the end? And then I'd like for you to let us know if we're too slow in one area. You know, we don't mind being prodded and moved along. So
no, I'm just going to let you take off here. And if my committee members want to ask a question, if they prefer to wait, that's fine. If they have some pressing questions, I'll call on.
Great. Okay. So the first slide.
Representative Poff.
We've been a cabinet agency since 2003. Previously, the Office of Higher Education was HESO, an independent agency, for about 10 years. And before that, it was a coordinating board. And a coordinating board with responsibility for program oversight, et cetera. We don't have that responsibility any longer. That responsibility ended at about the time that the Minsky system came together in its merger. We have about 7 or so employees at the agency. About half are state-funded. The rest are funded with either our loan program that I'll talk with you about later or through federal funding. We work very closely with higher education systems, public and private. We have several advisory groups, including students, and we work with K-12 folks and the P16 Council that some of you may be familiar with. On this slide, I just wanted to highlight some of the programs that we'll go into greater depth later on. But in terms of financial aid, we have grants at our agency. We have one of the largest need-based grant programs in the country. That's money you don't have to pay back. Loans, we have a self-loan program. That is a supplemental loan program. It's not need-based, and it offers a competitive interest rate a little lower than the bank rate, but a little higher than the federal subsidized rate. We have work-study programs, tuition and reciprocity agreements. We oversee those, and I'll talk about that with you later, giving you an update. And then the college savings plan. Every state has one, and we have one as well, overseen by TIAA-CREF. We have a policy analysis and research role, a lot of information on accountability, enrollment, tuition, and financial aid. And we provide budget and policy advice to the governor. That's a new role for the agency. Before, when the governor's budget was rolled out for higher ed, I think the finance department testified. Now that's something that we're doing. Program coordination, consumer protection. We regulate private institutions through licensing and registration, both for-profit and non-profit. We coordinate a number of programs, including the Minitex and MinLink Library programs and the Learning Network. I have Emily Cassane from our agency here today who works on those programs, and I think I saw Bill DeJean here as well. Outreach and information, we provide a lot of targeted college readiness support and information to students, and then initiatives. Some of those are given to us, and some of those we take on ourselves. For example, the textbook report, we have finished that, and we'll share that with you at the end of the meeting. But that's something that there was not a bill passed directing us to do that last year, but we decided to take it on anyway, and we have put a report together for you. On the next slide, this shows you the geographic distribution of higher education institutions in our state. U of M is in pink, I think that's right. Blue for Minsky, yellow for the universities. State colleges are blue, universities yellow, private colleges orange, and proprietary schools, those are the for-profits, are green. But I think the point of this slide is to show you that there's clustering where there are population centers, and there's fairly good geographic access throughout the state. The next slide just gives you a quick snapshot of what enrollment looks like in Minnesota. We've got about 365,000 students in the fall of 05. 79% of those are undergraduates and 21% are graduate students. You can see the vast majority of students are at the two-year schools, community and technical, about 112,500 students. University of Minnesota and the private colleges enroll very similar numbers, around 46,000-47,000 undergraduate students. Minsky, obviously about 10,000 more, and then the for-profit schools, that's a growing sector, and particularly you see the growth is in the graduate program area. Mark is going to take the next several slides.
Mr. Chair, members, let me start with the first slide that gives you an overview of education spending in the state. We're working off 06 and 07 numbers on this chart, but the proportions are probably as close this year as they were last biennium. Roughly, the appropriation spending on education is roughly $2.8 billion for the two-year period. About 44% goes to the Minsky system, roughly $1.2 billion. Another $1.2 or about 43% is for the University of Minnesota. Our office gets the remaining 13%, which would be in the range of $350 plus million. If we could just turn to the next slide, and I'll show you some detail on that 13%. Most of the money, 92% of it, goes out in grants to in aid to students. This is a form of state grants, work study, child care, things of that nature. That's roughly $325 million. We have some grants to institutions, which makes up about 6% of the total, roughly $21 million. And then our administrative costs are 2%, or roughly $7 million for the biennium. So as you can see, most of the money that we handle in the agency is passed through money that goes out to students. Here's the next slide then, Mr. Chair and members. Just to get a little bit into the accountability work we've been doing for the last 2 years. Started in 05, there was the governor's recommendation to appropriate $400,000 for the biennium. It was $100,000 the first year and $300,000 the second year, and that was ongoing money. And the questions, of course, we had initially a few years ago were, well, why would we want to do this? Why do we need an accountability system for the state for higher education? And the reasons we gave to the members at that time was a little history. I mean, there's been some various attempts at higher education accountability since the early 90s. There's been some performance money and some bills early on. There's language directing both public systems to develop performance measures for the various institutions. But it was fairly limited. I think both institutions now do a very good job at it for their sectors. The University of Minnesota does a report that runs roughly 180 pages long. The Minsky system has been active in this. But there was a number of shortcomings in those approaches. And let me just mention a couple of them to you. There was nothing systematic about it. These were just for the individual sectors. It did not include the private sectors, for instance, either the for-profits or non-profits. So that was what we thought was one shortcoming. It wasn't an external look. I always think when we get to assessment kinds of things that you need an outside entity that tells you how well you're doing, because as we reflect on ourselves, we always tend to look better than others may see us. So it was that external look that we thought was important. It's not institution-based. We have no sense about running institutions or managing them. It is really a kind of a public agenda approach. And finally, it was a policy... the policy directive. The idea is, let's find out the information that you would need to set policy for overall higher education in the state. So those were the central kind of themes underlying the reasons why this project was undertaken. Two other things. We're, in a way, ahead of the curve. There's a significant national movement going on now in higher education accountability. Secretary of Education Spellings had a commission report that was released last fall. It was a major piece of research and analysis done that called on much more direction from the federal government and accountability. And just recently, the National Council of State Legislatures, NCSL, released another report on accountability. And I recall, Mr. Chairman, you made some comment about the next Friday's meeting in the Senate on NCSL. People will be here talking about that. Just briefly on the process, before I get to the five goals that you see in front of you on the slide. With the initial appropriation, the first thing we knew is that we didn't know much about this process. So we hired a national consultant, Dennis Jones, with the National Center of Higher Education Management Systems, NCHEMS. They've been at this kind of business analyzing higher education since the late 60s, so they have a good long history of working in it. Their reputation is high. We dealt with Pat Callen in the National Center for Higher Education and Public Policy. They're the group that does the Measuring Up report that measures higher education across the country by state, if you're familiar with that report. So they were helping us at the front end think through this. We brought in the NCHEMS people. They had a very data-intensive approach. They wanted to know what's really going on in the state with issues in higher education. The first meeting we had, Dennis Jones presented over 130 slides. Thankfully, you didn't have to endure that particular meeting. Maybe some of you were there. But again, very data-intensive. We had four meetings across the state with the large state group of stakeholders in the range of 80 to 90 people were there from all sectors and of all interest parties. Students, the business folks, and of course leaders from each of the sectors. January of last year, out of those meetings came a preliminary set of goals that Dennis and his folks then took around to meetings across the state. There was five across the northern tier of the state, five across the southern tier. I'm sorry, five meetings, but days, but two meetings in each day, so it was a total of 20 meetings. And again, the point of that was to check, you know, where are we at with these goals? Do they make sense to people? Have we missed anything? What can you tell us? Just another source of input as well. During last spring, then, Dennis fine-tuned the report. We worked on them quite a bit. And out of those meetings came the five goals that you see in front of you on the slide. And I'll just talk through them briefly, and I want to highlight the key points of these. Improve success for all students. And this was a focus on the kids that are underrepresented in higher education now. These tend to be low-income children from minority groups, and which are a growing part of our population as we look to the future. We want to create a responsible system that would meet the demands of the economy. Increase student learning and skill levels. This has to do with outcomes. How do we learn about learning outcomes in higher education? Contribute to research and workforce training. And then finally, provide access and affordability and choice. There are goals in statute currently for higher education. Dennis's folks did compare these to that set of goals. There is consistency. Last June, then, we had a final meeting of the large group where a final report was revealed. And since that time, we've hired a new staff person. We've come up with 18 different indicators for these five goals, quantitative measures to see how we're doing. We've working hard the last few months on collecting the data to fill in those indicators, and we expect the initial report to be released next week with Mr. Chair. Okay. Let me move on then, Mr. Chair, to the next slide. But I could maybe make one point on that report. If the Chair desires, I'm more than welcome to come back and just
go ahead.
The next slide kind of just talks about what we do in the agency and the areas that I work under. We look at the state grant program, and we do quite a bit of analysis on that to see how it's working against the current reality out in the world. We had a forum last year where a number of stakeholders came to these open meetings and described some of their concerns with it. We performed some analysis, and there's a significant report on our website. We analyzed higher education funding. And 2 years, what came out of this report 2 years ago, you will see some results of that report in the governor's bill dealing with the higher education funding system. A lot of discussion had to do with enrollment adjustments that I think Vice Chancellor King mentioned last week in this hearing, in this committee for higher education. And the 67% of instructional costs, we talked an awful lot about those issues in these meetings, and the report is out of it. There's a lot of new members on this committee. We can provide the members with these reports. And I suspect that this will come up in a conversation about the particular language, should you decide to hear that. The agency does a lot of studies, extensive reports on student debt and demographics, and finally we serve as a general data clearinghouse for enrollment, participation, and other related issues in higher education in the state. Now I'll turn it over to Mabel Cork to talk about the state aid programs.
Thanks, Mark. I'd like to cover the financial aid program listed here, and I'll spend a little bit more time on the state grant and go into some more details on that one. First of all, our state grant, as Susan said, is one of the largest state grants. We, in 2006, served 71,000 undergraduates and spent $124 million. We also have a child care program, which is unusual in the states. Most states do not have a child care program specifically for students. In Minnesota, we serve 2,600, and that program has been funded at $4.8 million. The work-study program, it's a little more common to have a work-study program. There's probably about 15 states in the nation that have a work-study program. Ours is one of the larger work-study programs. We serve 10,700 recipients, and they've earned $18 million towards their educational costs. We also have, as Susan mentioned, a loan program. Our loan program is funded by selling bonds, and the administration of that program is funded through the interest rates of those bonds. So it's a self-funded program. It does not take any state money. Each year we serve around 33,000 students and spend this last year spent $127 million. Let me spend a little bit more time on the state grant program. The state grant program is set up so that there are three entities that fund the educational costs for the students. The first one is the student. So the student has an assigned responsibility. The second one that comes in is the family, and if the family doesn't have enough money to cover that cost, then the last entity that comes in is the taxpayer. And I'd like to walk you through a picture of how this works. The first thing that we establish is the budget that we're going to use for the state grant. And that budget is made up of the tuition and fees charged at the institution and a living and miscellaneous cost. So living and miscellaneous cost is currently, at mid-year it was $5,750. We also, in statute, and you will be asked to set these limits, there's a four-year program maximum tuition, and there's a two-year program maximum tuition that are set in statute or in the law. The one that's used here, the maximum one is $9,438 for 4 years. Currently, the University of Minnesota Morris is above that, so you do have at least one public institution that is above that four-year max. The University of Minnesota Twin Cities is right at that max. So the first thing that we do then is set up the height of that line, which is the budget for the student. Next, the student share comes in, and those are those lines that go straight across. Notice that those lines do not fluctuate based on the income. We have zero income students down here, and then it goes up to the higher income students. That's set at currently at 46%, so that the student share is 46%. And again, that's set in statute. This is based on an investment. Each student is required to invest a certain amount in their own education. The next payer that comes in is the family, and we use the federal needs analysis and a slight modification of that for currently for independent students to set this line. You'll see that families who have incomes, and this is set up to be median families, you can make as a dependent family up to around $20,000 or so, and there will not be a requirement to pay. You will have zero contribution. At that point, then, from $20,000 up to about $65,000, you get an increase in that line. So the families are paying that dark blue part. Okay. So after the families, after we've evaluated what the families can pay based on their ability to pay, then we have the taxpayers coming in. And the taxpayers are those that striped area. The taxpayer area is made up of two parts. The first one is the Pell Grant, which you can see at the bottom here. And if the Pell Grant does not fill the taxpayer's responsibility, the state grant comes in on top of that. So you can see approximately how that fits in that taxpayer area. The next slide shows the number of recipients that receive the state grant, and you can see that it's focused on the low-income students. And the final slide that I'm going to cover gives you the dollar amount at the different income levels. That white bar shows the Pell Grant amount, and the blue amount is the total of the Pell Grant and the state grant. So that you can see together, they're much more focused on the low-income students and then taper off as they get into the higher-income students. There are always questions about the higher-income students. Keep in mind that it's based on the needs analysis, and if you have a larger family or if you have two or three kids in school at the same time, a family that shows a higher income would still show need because they would have so many kids to pay for at that time. Are there any questions?
We'll just let the speakers go in, and we'll open it up for questions.
We'll, Mr. Chair and members, we'll be talking about the proposals in these areas towards the end of the slide. This is sort of showing you what is in existence now in terms of programs at our agency. The next slide talks about our college savings plan. The purpose of it is to help people save for education expenses beyond high school. We have a contract with DIA CREF. They're the company that manages the program. Every state has one of these 529 plans, and the 529 refers to a code, IRS code. The investment options are managed allocation, all equity, and guaranteed. I'm not going to go into detail about those, but our person who manages the program for us is here today, and he's very willing to help if you have questions at our agency. Tax advantage earnings. The tax is deferred and tax exempt. And then the assets right now, we're up to $530 million in assets. And there are 42,100 account beneficiaries. Our family has two accounts for our kids. Matching grants are up to $300,000 a year for families with incomes less than $80,000. The next slide, I'm going to take a couple slides here to talk with you about several slides to talk about tuition reciprocity. The purpose of reciprocity is the mutual improvement of educational advantage for the residents of Minnesota and other states or provinces with whom these agreements are made. And these are contracts. We have a contract with North Dakota, a contract with South Dakota, a contract with Wisconsin. Then we have separate agreements with Manitoba and then several schools in Iowa. Our office is the negotiating entity, so we're authorized to enter into tuition reciprocity agreements in consultation with the Commissioner of Finance and each system's governing board.
And these agreements are valid when they're approved by these two governing boards, MNSC and the U of M. They can also choose to not approve the agreements, and that has not yet happened, but it is something that could happen in the future. The agreements are ongoing and reviewed annually by the office. On the next slide, our partners. Wisconsin's been a state with which we've had a reciprocity agreement since 1968, North Dakota since 1975, South Dakota since 1978, Manitoba since 1989, and I think the overall focus is that in terms of the benefits is it expands market choices and enrollment opportunities for state residents. A lot of those students that go away come back here to the state to work and live and raise their families, etc. Most Minnesota students who go to North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, as I said, come back. I just want to stick that quote in by Peter Zetterberg and John Kellogg from the university, but the point is that I think even though these folks go away, they come back, and students from other states who choose to go to school in Minnesota end up staying here and working here also. This is kind of an interesting slide, I think, because it shows the flow of students. If you look at this page here, the red line, the vast majority of the students are part of the Minnesota-Wisconsin agreement. You'll see that we send about 13,595 students over to Wisconsin, and they send us about 11,418. They just have one system. They don't have two separate public systems. It's just one there. North Dakota, you can see the flow there. 5,931 students come here, and we send about 8,089 over there. And South Dakota, there's far less students, but about 1,954 we send over there, and then 2,000 come back. Are there any questions on reciprocity?
Representative,
I could also, Mr. Chair, if I might, I could just give an update if that's what the questions are about. I could just tell you that right now we're in a negotiation with Wisconsin. We're in the middle of it. You may have read in the papers that the university has requested that we phase in the Wisconsin students so that there's parity. Right now what happens is that at the Twin Cities campus, the Wisconsin student pays about $1,200 less than the Minnesota student. That's because that agreement says that you pay the lower, you pay your own state's tuition. So our students pay their tuition over there, and their students pay their own tuition over here. It used to be fairly even, and it's grown significantly in the last several years. So at Morris, the difference is about $2,500, and at Duluth, I think it's around $1,800. I'd have to go back and check. But we have been going back and forth with Wisconsin. We've submitted a proposal that I'd be happy to share with you that reflects a phasing in up to the Minnesota rate, and we're in the middle of a negotiation right now with them.
Representative Wealthy.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina, and it's to that point about reciprocity. I know a constituent is talking to me about this issue because he sent a couple of his students over to Wisconsin, and he's really worried that if Minnesota does something, that it could put the reciprocity in jeopardy for both states. And so his point was that even though Wisconsin students are paying less when they come to Minnesota, that there are dollars to be made up between the two states. Can you tell me that for all of the students, you took all the students and you worked out the difference between how much they pay here and we pay over there, and there's a gap. Does the state make up that total gap, or are there still dollars that are being lost in the state of Minnesota to Wisconsin?
Chair Rokovina and Representative Welty, yes, the piece that I didn't mention is there's a truing up at the end every year, and there's a payment that goes. We used to make a payment to Wisconsin for the difference. Now that payment comes here, and they make a $7 million payment to our general fund. The question is, you know, one of the questions that's been raised is should that payment be directed towards the University of Minnesota and the MNSC to try to, you know, fill in that hole. You still have the tuition difference, but, you know, on its face, the sticker price, let's say, but you'd be able to try to fill in the hole somewhat. But, yes, there's a payment that's made between the states.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina. And just a follow-up to that, Ms. Seagarden, and that is that I think the one concern was that if the dollars are coming back in and they're just going to the state's general fund, that they're not necessarily directed to MNSC or the University of Minnesota, so that our higher ed institutions are not benefiting from that payment directly. And I guess I would have to agree with that if it's not coming back to the general fund specifically for higher ed. And I think that's one thing that the committee should consider. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olsey, that's something that, you know, we're looking at lots of different options right now. That's one of the options that, of course, we're taking a look at. We're talking with the Department of Finance and with the university and with MNSCU about that. But to one of your earlier points about the uneasiness of students, I would like to just say that if there was ever a change in the agreement, if the agreement, we don't plan on the agreement going away, but if it were ever to go away, that remote possibility, there's like a four-year grandfather, there's a four-year kind of wind-down period that protects students, and if there was a change in the agreement, people would be phased in. So our goal is to make sure that students, they should not be uneasy, they should just sit tight, and they're not going to be affected in the very near future.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any one of you that wants to pop up, Ms. Seagard probably is the one that will answer. How common is it that states have reciprocity agreements with their adjacent neighboring states, number one? And the second part of the question is, have the economics and the reasons for this in our kind of our culture and what's happening right now in the state changed enough so that maybe it's time to just get rid of this stuff and let competition work?
You gotta go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I'd be happy to send you the phone calls that I've been getting from the concerned parents. I think there are a lot of people who are still really value these agreements, and I think it'd be unfortunate to have them go away at this time. At some point in time, perhaps, but I think we're still seeing value in having an agreement among states in the upper Midwest. We're a region here, and I think it still does make a lot of sense to keep this in place. And we've done some analysis, some economic analysis. I think in some of the graduate programs we're able to show, I know we looked at one program, the pharmacy program, at Wisconsin students coming here to the university's pharmacy program, and many of those students stay here to work, and they don't go back to Wisconsin. So we've been looking, doing some of that analysis. We'd like to do some more, but I think there is some evidence that these people do stay here to work and live.
Go ahead.
My first question, you didn't answer that one. Are there other states that do this to their geographically contiguous states?
I apologize. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, no, this is a unique, really unique to the upper Midwest. We're not aware of any other states that have reciprocity agreements like this. There are compacts, like the Midwest Compact has an agreement where it's between among institutions, you know, where you can charge 150% of the resident tuition rate to students, but it's not among states. This is a different setup.
Okay, go on then. Oh, excuse me, a whole bunch of other names. Okay, I thought we'd actually have you finish, but if this is pressing, Representative Norris, is it on reciprocity?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Go ahead.
Mr. Seagard, does Wisconsin have a higher or lower, I'm trying to clarify in my mind, do they have a higher or lower tuition rate than Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, their tuition is lower in most cases. It would depend on some of the communities or four-year schools. There might be, it might be fairly even and in some cases higher, but at the University of Minnesota, that's the crux of the issue here. At the University of Minnesota, there's disparity of $1,200 at the Twin Cities campus, $1,800 roughly at the Duluth campus, and then $2,500 at Morris. So it's really a issue particular to the University of Minnesota at this point in time. They're the ones that have come forward to ask us to try to renegotiate.
Mr. Chair, just
go ahead.
I was just noticing that there are, you know, far more students going to Wisconsin from Minnesota than coming this way, and I was just curious if that reflects on a perception of a quality difference or if it's all tuition.
Seagard?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, we'll look more deeply into that. I don't think it's really a quality difference. I think it's that there are different options along the border, you know, for Minnesota students and vice versa for some of the Wisconsin students coming here. Winona State has a lot of Wisconsin students attending their campus. Similarly, Eau Claire, River Falls, La Crosse, you find a lot of Minnesota students at those schools as well.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Representative Detmer, is it for this point? On yes. Reciprocity?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Heegaard, I think I heard you mention that Wisconsin has a one system versus our two system here in Minnesota. What are your thoughts about that?
Well,
Ms. Heegaard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, you know, that's not something that we've, the administration, the governor's I guess, directed me to look at this point in time. I think there are others before me that have tried to look at this. I think former Governor Anderson, there was a task force that looked at whether or not there ought to be one system. I think that's certainly a question, you know, that will come up again. I don't really feel at this point in time that it's something that we're entertaining or thinking about, but it's certainly something that comes up periodically. And of course, we look at Wisconsin, and they look at us, and there are things we like about what they do, and there are things that they like about what we do. So,
okay, thank you.
Members and administrators, I'd like to recognize the students in the audience that have come from all over, that are your students, I believe, most of them in the Minnesota system. So welcome to the Capitol, and maybe I should let one of you have the gavel and come here and ask some questions. I don't want things to get out of control just yet.
Wait a minute.
I'm waiting till a little farther into the legislative session. Representative Mahoney.
Well, my question is, it doesn't have a ton to do with reciprocity, but you mentioned it when you talked about the pharmacy students coming here and then actually staying here. How long do you track your students? I mean, are you tracking them for 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years out?
As far as they're staying in the state? Go ahead.
Representative Rokovina and Representative Chair Rokovina and Representative Mahoney, you know, we actually, the systems, the institutions are the ones that really track the students, and we get some of our data. We get our data from them. I need to go back and talk with the university. I don't know kind of long-term whether they're looking at 5 year, 10 years. I'm not sure, but I could certainly get back to you on that point. And we're open to suggestions. If you have some recommendations for us, we'd be happy to consider those.
I'm sure we can talk a little later. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Haas.
Yeah, thank you. To that point, just help me with this so I'm understanding it thoroughly. When the Wisconsin student goes to Minnesota, he gets to pay, or she gets to pay, the lower Wisconsin tuition in Minnesota. And when the Minnesota student goes to Wisconsin, we get to pay the higher Minnesota tuition in Wisconsin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Haas, that's correct. You pay your in-state, under the Wisconsin Amendment, your in-state tuition. Under the North Dakota Agreement, for example, you pay the higher of the two. But in this particular agreement that was developed way back when, somehow, some way, somebody decided that each state should pay their own. And at one point in time, ours was lower than Wisconsin's. So it switched.
I liked it better when it was the other way.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas, if we, you know, we have the opportunity maybe to equalize that, but it might take a little, you know, courage on the part of a lot of us to do that. So I know you've got a lot of courage. You remind me, you know.
Of Uncle Louie, yeah. I don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick question. For a student, for example, coming from Iowa who wanted to become a resident in Minnesota, they just have to live here a year to become a resident, right?
Who wants to?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is about 12, is it 12 months?
That's
without
a year
going
where
to
I
school.
Come
yeah. 12 months, a year, without going to school first.
Without going to school.
Oh. Without going to school.
About every 12 months.
Being at least less than half time. Come to
you have a calendar.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you can't come to the state to go to school. You need to be here for a year, and then you can go to school.
Or not carry a full load.
No, you can't.
You can't go at all?
You've got to be less than half time.
Okay. Representative Clark?
Well, the reason I'm asking is I know the governor was saying a lot about, you know, students that we were talking about with the Dream Act, they had from Iowa, they would have a whole much bigger advantage than students from Iowa, but all they have to do is live here a year. And I think the Dream Act just lived here 3 years. You know, you took all this graduate from Minnesota school for 3 years. I'm just trying to get clear about this. If a student wanted to be a resident in Minnesota, they would be less than a full-time student, half, I guess, and be here a year, and they would have the same. They would have the opportunity. So just to clarify that, because I think there was a lot of misinformation out there about that.
Yes, I know there was. Representative Atkins, you have a long question. Go ahead.
I'll pass. I have a deference to you, Mr.
No, go ahead. We've opened it up. Okay. And then, Ms. Hegard, why don't you just continue, and then we'll open it up for all types of questions.
Great.
And I may ask a student or two to come up and tell us what kind of job they think you're doing. Is that okay?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Miskanis is going to take the next slide, and I'll switch back after him.
Mr. Chair, members, and I can go over this quite quickly, we do have a regulatory and consumer protection role in the agency, and that deals with, not with the public institutions, of course, but with all the private institutions in the state. There is just a bit more than 150 of them, and they range from institutions the size of St. Thomas, with well over 10,000 students, to the diving school up in Brainerd, where there's 6 students. When I say diving, I mean this is underwater welding, so it's a very actually profitable occupation. So that's the full range of private institutions. And what do I mean by regulation? There's actually two major components. One is that we analyze their financial statements to make sure that they're financially capable and stable. So that they're not going to shut down, hopefully not shut down next month and leave students in the lurch. And then the second major role is to evaluate their programs to make sure that they meet minimum requirements for the degrees that they're offering. So if you're going to offer a four-year degree, you have to meet certain requirements that are set out in the rule, diplomas and certificates as well. So that's the two major regulatory roles. We also, under this area, investigate student complaints, and we do get complaints from the full range of schools. And students, of course, often don't have another place to turn to. So we act as intermediaries for them with their issues with various private institutions. We deal with all the new institutions that have come in the state to make sure that these requirements are met. And finally, we do have an audit function that goes into the private schools, evaluates our financial aid programs, make sure that they're following the appropriate rules and regulations.
Mr. Chair, before I continue, I'd like to have Dr. Maplethorpe just make a point of clarification on the residency. And Representative Clark has left, but I just, for the record, like her to respond.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, we were giving an answer for residency for an independent student, a student who could move anywhere, and we were just, and they were sort of self-contained. If there is a student who's a dependent student, which means they're under the age of 24 and some other things, but if they're a dependent student, they are a resident of the state in which their parents live. So if the parents are still living in Iowa and the student comes up here to Minnesota and they're a young person, they would still be a resident of Iowa. The institutions, if the concern was whether or not the person was paying in-state or out-of-state tuition, the institutions make that decision. If the concern was whether or not they were eligible for a state grant, then our agency would make that decision.
Continuing on with the next slide, this focuses on the Learning Network, the Minitex, and MinLink Library programs. The Learning Network really is the pipeline up to the door of the institution. It allows for technology to make it to the campus, and it's very valued, I think, throughout the state, particularly in greater Minnesota. Serves all public post-secondary institutions, and I think there's some privates that can opt in or buy into this. Core telecommunications network infrastructure, there's internet data, video, and voice services, and access to global research networks. And with the amount of data that's being sent back and forth, you know, between campuses and communities nowadays, it's critical to keep that healthy. And we'll talk about an appropriation to expand this later in the presentation. The Minitex library program, that focuses on interlibrary loans, statewide document delivery, the Electronic Library for Minnesota, or ELM, as some of you may know it, and group purchasing of online databases. One of the things I think that's really unique, if you haven't visited the Minitex document delivery place in the basement of the U over by the river in Minneapolis, is that you can be in almost any location in the state, and within 5 or so days, my understanding is you can get almost any document that you want, either electronically on the commuter or in your hand, the actual book or document that you're seeking. So it's really a wonderful access piece for the state. The MinLink program, it's focused on public library patrons searching, allowing them to search multiple library catalogs, and it gives access to online tests and texts and electronic resources. The next slide just focuses on our information that we have at our agency. One of our statutory obligations is to provide information for parents and students. We receive requests for 350,000 publications every year, and our staff make presentations year-round. We have a number of great resources. If you go to our website, you can download, or we'll send to you a guide to paying for college, a guide to choosing college, and they're in several languages if you are interested in that.
We also have an agency website, www.ohe.state.mn.us, and on there you'll find lots of updated information. If you're looking for data, that's the place to go. We also provide a link to our agency initiatives if you want to see how we're doing on the things you've asked us to do and the things you haven't asked us to do. You can look there. Then we also have a link that connects to a second website for students and parents. And one of the things that I want to note about this is that there's a clicking place for preparing for college, selecting a college, and paying for college. Those are really the three critical things that students need to focus on when they're wanting to go to college. We also have a financial aid estimator, and it's kind of a fun thing. You can plug in your information, federal grants, federal loans, tax credits, deductions, and find out how much financial aid, if any, you might be eligible for at the state and the federal level. So it's a very handy tool on our website. Right now, we're in the middle of a college encouragement campaign. It's coordinated by our office. Our partners include the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the Private College Council, the Career College Association, or the for-profit schools, and our office. We also have partnered with the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, better known as MMEP, the Campus Compact, and the Department of Education. We've all put some money in. We're engaged in a media campaign, and we'll be having a TV spot and then some advertising on buses and bus stops this spring, trying to educate students about college and what the steps you need to take to get there. We have an intervention for college attendance program, ICAP. It's centrally run through our agency. We received appropriations to provide $446,000 to 14 programs in Minnesota in 2006. The grants are awarded on a competitive basis. The recipients are secondary institutions and community agencies. And the purpose is to expand the pre-college awareness programs for low-income students. We also have a federal Gear Up grant that funds our Get Ready program. That serves 2,100 students in 8 low-income schools in the metropolitan area. We provide tutoring, career awareness, campus visits, summer academic enrichment curriculum, and student advising to students. So those teachers are working right in, our staff are working right in the classroom with these teachers. Targeted low-income students and families, particularly families with no previous post-secondary education, a lot of first-generation families. We also, in order to give access to folks in greater Minnesota, we provide curriculum and outreach to teachers throughout the state. So we serve about 17,000 students through outreach services, and we'd love to be serving more. Now on to the budget. Dr. Michikanis and I are going to sort of share this, but what I wanted to talk about, first of all, is that overall the increase for higher education is about 14.8% over base, just to provide some context.
Is that ongoing into the next biennium then?
No, some of that, Mr. Chair, is ongoing and some of that is one.
How much is ongoing?
Money. I can answer that better as we work through the specific slides. Can I get back to that?
But I just want us to understand 14.6% really isn't 14.6%. So.
Mr. Chair, if I can maybe give you the pieces. About $90 million at the university is ongoing. The governor's rec is 153 total. About $72 million is ongoing at Minsky, out of $123 million total. The money in our agency is all ongoing. That includes state grant pieces, the Achieve program, and the GI Bill. So there's quite a bit of ongoing money there.
And then the Mayo Clinic is one time.
Correct.
Yes.
So aside from your office, how much of the 14.6% gets, what does it get reduced to?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe at Minsky it's roughly at the University of Minnesota it's about an 8.3% increase. And at Minsky, at Minsky it's about 8.3, and at the University of Minnesota it's roughly 10%.
And do you know offhand what we cut them when we did cut them a few years ago, what the percentages were?
Mr. Members, the amounts were in the range of $85 million a year, I believe. Mr. Bird could probably give you a more exact number on that. And the percentages would have been larger because it came off the lower base. Not larger than these numbers. It would have been larger because it's off the lower base.
Representative,
that was
okay.
My question.
All righty, I'm sorry for interrupting. Go ahead. Representative Moore, do you have a question?
Just a quick question.
On this?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will you be, when you're presenting this information, I know it'll be hard for you because institutions make tuition decisions, but estimates of what the effect on tuition will be for these, for the numbers that you're working with, both in our current biennium with one-time money and then in the future years? Biennium's given the current budget, will you be able to kind of at least address that as you go forward with your presentation, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative Moore, when it comes to the discussion about the state grant program, we are required, forced to make those kind of assumptions. So if you would give us a few minutes, we can return to that question.
Thank you.
Just a couple more context points, Mr. Chair and members. There are going to be several criticisms of the governor's budget, and I'd just like to hit that head on. One is that there's not enough money overall. As we mentioned, you know, there's roughly 8% and 10% for the UMinsQ ongoing money. If you look at healthcare, for example, and the governor's mentioned this several times, the growth in the healthcare area alone is 13% without any additional resources added, new programs, etc. So, I guess the governor's feeling is just if you look across state government, you can't look at each of these spending areas in isolation. That in terms of context, it's important to look at the pressures, the demographics, et cetera, in all of these areas because everything is affected. Higher ed has gotten squeezed in the past. I think if you looked across the country, half the states at least made decisions to reduce higher ed spending, and I think they looked at tuition as a valve. I mean, that was what happened across the country. We're coming out of that. I'm very happy that we're able to provide more resources, but we were not alone in facing a very difficult budget situation a number of years ago. So the first criticism is going to be there's not enough money, and then the second, I think, is going to be, well, when you look at the MinSQ and the U budgets, it's tipped to certain areas. Why didn't you fund the salaries or the inflation? And we'll get to that, but the governor's position, I think, is that this is the beginning of a process. It's now in your hands. But he wanted to make sure that the strategic priorities that the systems laid out were funded. And so he followed those. He didn't add any new ones in terms of the ongoing money. He stayed with their recommendations. But that's where he tipped the money towards those areas. And then finally, there may be some criticism of performance funding. Why on earth are you doing this? What's the point? The governor, and there was a theme in his State of the State speech and across the budget of trying to inject some principles of performance in across state spending. And in terms of higher education, he put one-time $25 million of one-time money for the U, $25 million for MinSQ. And what we did is we looked inside of the MinSQ and U strategic plans to look at areas where the money could be linked, and they were their programs and not things that we invented or cooked up. They're particular to their MinSQ budgets, just to clarify, MinSQ and the U budgets. So with that, I guess I'd hand off the next piece to Dr. Michikanis. He and I are going to tag team throughout this piece of the presentation.
Mr. Chair, I think it may be more beneficial for me to talk about just the differences, not the particular pieces, because you've heard from both systems, and I think you know the content and the makeup of those particular requests, but perhaps our focus on the differences may be more useful, but I will certainly be able to respond to questions if they arise.
Sure, go ahead.
As Ms. Seagard mentioned, let me start with the MinSQ slide because it's the one in front of you. The first piece under the $6 million for the service or underrepresented students, is half the MinSQ request. They had this is $6 million a year, $12 million for the biennium. They had requested $24 million total. The next one, four pieces, ranging from allied health down to the management innovations, are at the levels requested by the Board of Trustees from MinSQ. The last request for technology is lower. They requested $70 million for 08 and 09, and the recommendation is 60, and then they had requested $40 million of ongoing money annually, or $80 million for 10 and 11, this recommendation contains only $15 million annually, or $30 million for the 2010-2011 biennium. I want to suggest one thing. Of course, and the last thing is he didn't fund the $57 million for the compensation inflation. This is, I want to suggest, consistent with all the other recommendations across the budget for the governor. The systems are raising, in this case MinSQ, about $83 million in a tuition change and reallocations internally. I'm not sure these are documents, but these were numbers that they presented to you when they made the presentation, but I know that they did come up in conversations with the Department of Finance. That would cover about a 2% increase in compensation and other costs. And I'll just mention now, likewise, universities are saying their tuition increases and reallocations would cover about a 2% increase in compensation and other costs. As you, I suspect, are aware, in K-12, the governor has recommended a 2% increase for the school districts. And for all the state agencies, while he has the Department of Finance built in a 3.25% cost increase, he has funded 2%. So 2% is consistent in this case. And, of course, the governor, like the systems, have to recognize tuition as a source of revenue. So although he hasn't funded the request, his recommendations are consistent across all budget areas.
And Ms. Kanz, that would, you know, be, a philosophical question as to whether that's the right approach or not. You mentioned the K-12 system. It would be probably the local property taxpayers then that would pick up that other dollar amount. In this case, it's everybody sitting in this room that just walked in here. So there is a little difference, being that the property tax system is spread to businesses and homeowners and absentee landlords and the cabinet. And certain business taxes are a state tax now, but there is a little difference there.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'll just suggest that as if the governor went through his process, you'll have to struggle with how much you'll want to pay for inflationary increases as well, so it's not an easy business.
Well, you know it isn't. And then when you pretend that nothing's going up on the revenue and on the spending side, it exacerbates the problem a little bit too.
I simply wanted to talk about that, so the impression isn't left with members that there's zero available for those costs that, of course, are going to incur in the system.
Okay. Sorry I interrupted you.
I don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mo.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, a 2% funding increase in the system, and knowing, we all know full well that there's going to be additional costs to our institutions. I mean, we're kind of accepting with this budget that it's going to be pushed off in a different direction. Am I correct? I mean, and what is the most readily available direction, or what's been used over the last 8 years for funding the additional higher education needs? I mean, it seems pretty clear where this would go. And do you understand what? Do you follow me here? I mean, where is the money? The system going to come up with the additional? Say we adopt this budget as you're presenting, where would the additional revenue come from?
Which one of you want to handle that? Ms. Egard, you might want to handle that one.
Go ahead. Sure. Let me just speak from a management perspective. I mean, institutions are operated by the Board of Regents, the Board of Trustees, not by the administration or by the legislature. And they have to make management decisions. And clearly, they have some control over costs. If they don't get the funding for them, they have to make that decision. They make program decisions all the time on what programs stay and which don't. I know, Minsky was in last week talking about what they annually, or biannually, reallocate internally, and it's in the range of $25 million. It's a substantial number. So all these things, are dynamics occur in the same process. I should say that maybe it would be best now for me to speak to that tuition question because it's quite relevant to this conversation. As I mentioned, we have to make tuition assumptions for the state grant program because we have to pay for those costs within the structure that Ms. Maple-Pork had mentioned earlier. For the Minsky system, we're assuming a 4% increase because I think the members of the board have been fairly public that they're going to stay at that level regardless of the actions of the legislature. The Board of Regents has publicly talked about a 4.5% increase, but President Grunix has not been quite as firm, at least not that I'm aware of. So for our purposes, we've assumed a 5% increase, which I will admit will probably be a bit low, based on conversations I've had with Mr. Fitzenwright over there. So we're trying to take those into account in our budgeting for the state grant program. Well aware of that. And this is probably the first time that we've done this with the Minsky system. 2 years ago in the budget process, we assumed higher numbers. And again, not to kind of peg tuition because we don't know. But I think it's only fair when we present a budget to you on the state grant side that we try to recognize that trade-off between state appropriations and tuition.
Okay, Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I should have asked this question when we were back at the slide when we were looking at the state aid, but what percent of the state aid requests are you able to fulfill? What I think the chart showed was in an ideal situation, the state would cover that portion. And I'm wondering for the people who apply for state aid, are you able to fulfill all of the people who meet the need, or what percentage? And the reason I'm asking is, you know, we were talking about a tuition freeze proposal earlier today, and the students are interested in that. And I'm wondering if we were able to pass some funding separately to allow MinSCU to freeze tuition, would that help you make the state aid available to more people, or is there not a need? Are you filling the need that's out there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't see you, Hortman. Thank you. Right now, we're able to fill the need. I mean, the students that have need, according to the current formula that's in place, we're able to fund those students. In fact, we have a surplus of revenues available, and you probably weren't around. I don't know if you were at the time, but there's been a surplus several times, and what's happened in the past is that money went just back to the general fund and was not able to be kept in the higher ed area. So two years ago, there was a law passed that said any additional revenue, the surplus in the grant program would go towards the living and miscellaneous account. So we actually, in the last year, were able to award about 800 additional state grant dollars to students. But we don't have a shortage. We, in fact, have a surplus. That's not to say, though, and we'll talk more about our recommendations in just a few minutes. We're making some recommendations that we enhance the grant program and provide more funding to students because it's in need of an update.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You know what I'm going to do here, members, is this. I know there's a couple other members. I'm going to ask you, Ms. Hegard, to get on with, why don't you just skip over and go to your slides here, or your recommendations for your office, the Achieve and the GI and the state grad program, and then maybe since we have some students here from all around the state, we could get them on to comment on what they might think of that. So, members, if we could hold our
questions. Slide, Mr. Chair, slide 35.
Yes. Start with the Achieve 2.
Yep. Mr. Chair and members, I'll start off, and then Dr. McKenna will finish up a little bit here. But on the Achieve 2 scholarship, I think you may remember the governor came out this summer with a proposal, Achieve, to reward students in the top 25% of their high school classes with free tuition at a MinSCU or U of M institution. It was 4 years of free college. Actually, the two free and then two more if you graduated in a science, technology, engineering, or math area. I think you heard the criticism about the proposal. One of the primary criticisms was there's a focus on students who are already going to college. He heard that and he came forward with a compromise proposal. This is different. This really focuses on two areas, college preparation and saving for college.
Okay. Mr. Chair, let me talk about some of the mechanics of the program. And as you can see from some of the details on that slide, but let me summarize. It's directed towards families of adjusted gross income of $100,000 or less. That's about 83% of the families in the state. It would offer per course a credit of $314. The courses are established in the bill that, in fact, Mr. Chair, you're the author of.
It's just a courtesy. Don't get any ideas.
But if members do have that bill in front of you, it's House File 675. It states out the definition of qualifying courses. These are advanced placement courses, or if you may have taken that advanced placement examination, that would qualify post-secondary enrollment options courses, concurrent enrollment courses, colleges and schools, courses if they're earned via work-based learning, and the CLEP test, the collegiate level examination program. These are all clearly identifiable kinds of programs that students take. There was conversation, of course, about rigor, and that has been in the news and the press, taking rigorous courses, but it's really hard to put your stake in the ground what constitutes a rigorous course and which doesn't. So I think the decision was made to adopt these because when you take an AP class, people know it. I mean, you have to sign up for it, and it it does take a involvement that way. The students, there's no limit on the number of credits or courses a student could take to earn the money. It's available only to be used as a scholarship to Minnesota post-secondary institutions, but it does include both public and private institutions. And the money would be paid when the student graduates from high school. The idea is that we would probably operate the same way we do with the state grant program at the institution level. There is going to be a part of an issue about transcripts and having the high school send transcripts to the post-secondary institutions and what constitutes a qualifying course and which doesn't. And that maybe creates some administrative difficulties, but in order to make this thing work, it's going to have to be a necessary piece. And there's another problem, or some administrative issue with documenting income itself for students that actually file FAFSAs or apply for financial aid, rather. That income would be on there, but that may not always be the case, so that would be an issue as well. This would affect about 29,000 students by our estimates, and cost about $46 million annually.
You know, it's 22, and how long is it going to take you to go through the veterans proposal?
Mr. Chair, I can go through it very quickly. It just depends on the questions that arise. But
go ahead.
I can click through that pretty quick.
After you get that, I'm going to call down maybe a president.
Okay. And then I'd like to just have a chance for us to walk through the state grant record, too, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Quick. On the GI Bill, Mr. Chair and members, there's $30 million that's been recommended for this program, $15 million a year. The eligible students would be veterans and the spouses and children of 100% disabled or deceased veterans. We'd be figuring in financial aid. There's federal money that some veterans get. There's many of them will qualify for financial aid. And one of the things that we try to pay attention to is that there are inequities among veterans, depending upon where and how long you've served. So that's another goal here, is to try to get some parity so that there's more evenness in terms of what veterans are paid. The benefit would equal the amount remaining after subtracting out the federal grants and the state grants and any federal veterans benefits, up to $1,000 a term, a maximum of $3,000 a year, or $10,000 total. And again, there was an issue that came up yesterday. You know, $1,000 doesn't seem like a lot of money per term, but if you factor in the state grant money and also the federal money, it's a good chunk of change for veterans. And so when we'll be testifying on this bill over here, I think, on Friday morning, and I'll talk about that more extensively with you. But there are some folks who feel that's not enough, and I want to make sure that we walk through with you later why we think that it is, actually. On the grant program, Ms. Miscanis will take that.
Mr. Members, let me talk just about a couple pieces. The recommendation includes three different changes. One is, Ms. Napier talked about the tuition maximums earlier. The recommendation here would be to raise those by $400 a year. The second piece, she again mentioned the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. The recommendation would be to increase that by $200 a year for students. And then finally, you see on the slide is a reference to the tax rate. This is the assessment rate that's within the federal needs analysis. If you recall Ms. Mapleport's earlier charts where she talked about the assigned family responsibility, it is a very progressive assessment rate. I talked about it in terms of a tax rate. For a family in the range of $65,000 a year, the marginal tax rate is about 47%, which is dramatic. And people on the tax committees would roll their eyes at a rate that high, especially at a family income level of that amount. And the recommendation here is to try to mitigate that rate structure somewhat, not as much as you'd like to, but by 5 percentage points, because we think it's just too progressive.
Okay. With that, members, I'm going to just ask the two presidents, if they're here, or somebody from the student organizations, if they might want to come down and talk about this. And by the way, I did not orchestrate this coordination between what's been happening here today and the fact that the students showed up. It just is, I guess, divine intervention or serendipitous or whatever you want to say. But come on down and identify yourself for the tape and just tell me what you think, at least, of the governor's proposals regarding those three programs.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina.
Or any of them, if you want to talk.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina members. My name is Scott Formal. I've been here before, but president of the Minnesota State College Student Association with the two-year campuses. I didn't plan on actually speaking today, but since you asked me to come down.
I didn't plan on letting you. I started in the audience, so I want you to earn your money in front of all your constituents.
Okay, well, I'll do my best to do that. One of the things that I testified in front of the Senate Higher Education Committee last week, and one of the specific requests there was to address the governor's budget proposal and how it affected higher education. And one of the things that I pointed out, and which I found interesting from the governor's proposal, is when talking about the Achieve 2 program, he has $92 million dedicated to Achieve 2. But at the same point in time, if you look at the K-12 proposal, I believe there's $75 million in that proposal that's being dedicated to the same group of students when you're talking about the rigorous courses. From a student's perspective, it's not as though we're not supporting that high school to college transition, but do you really need two different programs and $167 million being dedicated to one targeted group when the average Minsky student is 26.3 years of age? And at this point in time, as students, we feel that it would be best to take that $167 million, find the best program to help those high school to college transition students, but then use the rest of that money to help the average Minsky students, which would go a long way towards funding a tuition freeze and inflation and some of the other areas that the governor's budget seems to be lacking.
Do you have any comment on the veterans proposal at all?
we didn't really address that as much as a student association. We are in support of the veterans bill and the veterans proposal. So I acknowledged it, that it was there, and currently we do support that, but we are not in support of the $92 million going to Achieve 2 for a targeted group of students when the majority of, especially Minsky students, are well over the age of high school graduation.
And do you have a counterpart from the four-year?
I don't know if Justin McMartin, the chair, is here today. There are some university students here, but I don't know that any of their top leadership is here.
Representative Mahoney, do you have a question for you?
No.
Representative Moore, did you?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Chief 2 program, it's interesting you bring that up, specifically designating scholarships for students who PSEO, advanced placement classes. I know in the district I represent, some students don't have those classes available to them because of the other financial challenges their district has. I mean, has your group talked about that at all, student group, or just a simple fairness issue, even if we did go forward with that program? Have you considered that? And if not, maybe the Department of Higher Ed could address that point too.
Chair Gavina and Representative, we have talked about that a little bit, in the fact that there does seem to be some issues with fairness and the availability for high school students to be attending colleges. And even though we haven't addressed it as an association, some of the research that I've done, and from what I understand from the governor's proposal, is in the K-12 proposal, that 3-hour program is allowing opportunity for high school students to take more rigorous courses through online courses and to be able to take the college courses and actually prepare them for college through that program, which may be a little more accessible to the high schools, especially since I believe Minsky currently does offer that service to a number of high schools around their campuses too, where they're sharing that technology and making that available in the high school setting so that they can be taking those courses and getting the college credits to be able to transfer into college. Where the Achieve 2 proposal to us is kind of like, it's putting a double bang into the one pot, and you're not only allowing them the opportunity to take those courses in high school or to go out to the campus as a PSO and actually take them on campus, but then the Achieve 2 is also paying them additionally on top of it. Instead of, in addition to just covering the cost of the courses and providing it to them, they're actually being paid then for future aspects too. And And that's where, as students, at least with our association, that we don't believe it's necessarily fair that that smaller group of students get twice as much being targeted to them when the average student is. It excludes a number of current students.
Representative Norton, is your question for the same?
Yeah, to the point. I actually really appreciate your comments today, because this particular Achieve 2 proposal was one of the proposals that I found intriguing. But I think you raise an excellent point in the duplication. And as I've been listening to the conversation, and I think the earlier presenter talked about the difficulty in defining what a qualifying course is, I, at least in the community I come from, our low-income and minority student ratio of taking AP courses is extremely low, and it's an area we've been working on. We have honors courses and regular-level courses that would prepare students for college, and it sounds awfully like it's maybe not going to reach the population that we'd like or be very restrictive, and it would be the same students being given the increased opportunities rather than providing new opportunities. So I just thought I would thank you for bringing up that point, because I think this whole group is very interested in keeping tuition costs down, and if there is duplication, this might be a place we can free up some money. Thank you.
Representative Welke was to this point, too. Also.
Chairman Rukavina, it was to the point of Achieve 2, but I think I'll reserve my comments until we actually are debating Achieve 2, because I have a lot of questions about it. Thank you.
Okay, and before I forget, let's see. Representative McFarland, have you read the minutes? Would you like to move the minutes today?
I move the minutes be approved.
Thank you. We've heard the motion. Are there any questions or additions? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I like Representative Welty, I'll have some more comments when we are actually talking about the Achieve 2, but I think that the students have done a really good job when they've been at our offices, and I don't know if they've done it in front of our committee, of pointing out that when we had the cut, I shouldn't say we, when the legislature prior to when I got here had the cut of $191 million to the higher education institutions, $177 million of that was borne by these students in increased tuition. So to now have an Achieve 2 proposal that doesn't say, let's recognize that they were there for the state when the state was on hard times, I think is maybe not the approach that I would like to see the committee go.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess we're going to have this discussion to the Achieve 2 program, but I just want to make just a couple statements. I think, you know, on the campaign trail this last time around, one of the things that was predominant in the discussion was, how is our educational system doing? How do we compare with the rest of the world? Are we going to be competitive on a global market? And I think that goes to the very core of what we're talking about here, when we're talking not just about the PSEO, or do we have opportunities within our higher ed systems that allow those students who are accelerating at a faster pace than the normal to have an avenue to vent that in, that process of gaining that information. And I think the Achieve 2 carries that on, in that if there are people who are willing to take the extra time, make the dedication early in their life to achieve those goals, we need to make it as friendly for them as possible. I think that's a vision that we need to carry forward in this process, and instead of trying to create a level playing field for everyone, say, how do we compete on a world market in terms of our best people? So I think there's a couple sides to this discussion that needs to come out. Sorry. I forget to breathe when I talk.
Work on it. Former Representative Battaglia used to run out of breath as Representative Murphy and Clark remember, so at least you're not doing that yet. But appreciate your comments, and I'm sure that we'll be discussing this a lot more as we get nearer deadlines and putting the bill together. Ms. Heegar, well, thank you then, Scott, for your presentation. Ms. Heegar, go ahead. We've got about 7 minutes left.
I just Mr. Chair, a quick response to Representative Moe on the access issue. That's been raised several times, and I think that's something that we're very open to talking about. Are there ways to have better parity and access for students who might have those AP and IB and PSEO courses in their community? So we're very willing to work with members and others on that. And then to the other piece about kind of this being exclusive, I think the reason why we tried to broaden it and have work-based training programs and things in there was to keep it more broad and not exclusive, to bring more students in to have these opportunities. We left off at the, where did we leave off here?
I jumped over the Minsky one.
So, and we finished, let's see, Mr. Chair, we finished.
I think we were on.
You want us to continue moving forward?
31 or 32, I think you were on.
Yeah, so skip the system slide.
Oh, go ahead and go back.
We'll go back to the system
slide?
Okay. Back to...
I think you were on slide 32 when I interrupted
you. Yep, slide 32. I'm going to talk about this slide. This is the performance payment, $25 million one-time money for Minsku. And again, as I mentioned, this is tied to their strategic goals. One-time money is available on attainment of three of these goals, and we've talked with the system folks and with the chancellor and some of the board members about this. An increase of 5% or more students who take STEM courses. For those of you who don't know, that's science, technology, engineering, and math courses. We're releasing an accountability report next week. I think you will see, when you look at this report across all systems, we need to do a better job graduating students in these areas. We've got some national benchmarks, and it's troubling, both in the health and the STEM areas. Increase, and I'm not just pointing the finger at Minsky, it's across the board. An increase of 5% in enrollment in Upper Division Center of Excellence programs. As you know, Minsky has four Center of Excellence areas. There's a fifth proposed in the biosciences, and this would say that if you've enrolled, increased 5% in enrollment, that would be another benchmark that would have been reached. An increase of 1,400 students trained on electronic medical record technology. They've noted that as an important piece for them. Increase of 10% students taking online courses, or the number of online course offerings. We know that Minsky's really, really worked hard in this area and has offered lots and lots more courses online, and there's technology money in the budget for this purpose. And then finally, an expansion of 10% in awards of excellence or other initiatives that reward innovations and excellence and efficiency, sort of the Baldrige Awards, that sort of thing. I think that's what they were talking about, but this came from their strategic plan. Next slide on U of M.
Mr. Chair, members, the theme with the University of Minnesota is similar to Minsky. The governor is focusing on the strategic areas and fully funding those. And the university, when they constructed their budget, at least when we saw it earlier, it had kind of two parts. One was kind of the basic ongoing infrastructure. The second part was the strategic changes, and the governor did fund the strategic changes, and only a part, the technology part, was related to what they call sustaining the base. But again, the same conversation I had earlier applies here with the inflation and the 2% versus the tuition.
The next slide, slide 34, that's the U of M's performance payment, the $25 million, very similar to Minsky's. Again, we looked at their strategic plan and initiative. Increase of 5% or more in national faculty awards in arts, humanities, science, engineering, and health. Second, maintaining or improving the university's rank and national share of funding from the National Institutes of Health. Third, increase of 5% in postdoctoral appointees. An increase of 5% in financial support for renewable energy research. We know that there's lots of interest and focus in that area. An increase of 5% in high-value licenses to Minnesota-based businesses or venture-quality startup companies in Minnesota. And they would, again, have to reach at least three of those goals, and we'd be working very closely with the systems on these efforts.
Okay. Mr. Gard, you know, in the performance payments, is there anybody identified yet who's going to determine that the performance standards were met? Is it in any of your bills or budget proposals? Mr. Michikanis?
Mr. Chair, that would be our office working in consultation with the system offices and with the Department of Finance.
So who determines your performance?
I suppose, Mr. Chair, that might be you or the governor, but the bill says that we would be the ones deciding whether or not the criteria had been met, and then we'd work with the Department of Finance on the release of the money. But we'd be working very closely with the systems.
Okay. I didn't know. It was clear. And Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who would like to take this question, but I'm still struggling with the compensation issue and the inflationary question. And, you know, I see that the governor is willing to fund the University of Minnesota's competitive compensation request, and yet their base funding request for compensation of $67 million is not being funded. So I find it difficult to comprehend how the appropriate role of the use of that competitive compensation money when they're not able to raise their base funding to the level they feel is a fair compensation level. So they'll be spending that money to bring employees who they believe are being searched on a national level. They won't have enough money to bring them to the level they believe is competitive because they don't have the base funding. So, you know, I understand the 2% issue, but both the MNSCU and the U of M do not believe that 2% is going to be adequate to begin to address their compensation needs. You know, both their inflationary and compensation increases are in the $70 million range in requests. So I'm just wondering what your comment is on that.
Go ahead, whoever wants to
hand. Mr. Chair and members, I can understand the sense of a conflict between the two. The thing that's unique at the University of Minnesota, and I actually spent a short time working over there, is the nature of their faculty. These are people that are highly sought out, not just in the country, but around the world. They draw down millions in federal research money from NIH and NSF. Some of their startup costs and putting together labs and the like are very, very expensive. So I think the sense was that, especially with connecting this with ideas like the Mayo-U partnership, getting back to the competitive issues that we discussed earlier, I think that's the connection that the governor is trying to make with this recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ray, I do understand the role of that competitive compensation money. My point is that the base compensation is going to apply to faculty across the board, including these faculty who are being sought after, you know, across the nation or the world. And they can't bring their base salary up without, so they're going to be, that competitive compensation money is not going to go as far as the university is intending it to go if we don't fund the base. That's my point.
Mr. Chair, to your point, you know, there's always going to be a balancing act. Do you continue to fund the base operation versus do you fund the strategic initiatives or a little of both? And so I think that's something that the governor, I know the governor wrestled with that. And as I mentioned in my opening comments, his decision was to focus on the strategic elements and funding those in the budget. This legislature, this body may have a very different perspective on that, but that was his. And it's always a balancing act.
Okay, members, I guess the hour of 2 o'clock has arrived, but these folks will be back tomorrow, and Mayo is coming up to testify also. I'm going to put them on first because I think, you know, they've come from farther away. So we're looking forward to seeing you tomorrow. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned, members.
Thank you.